As we has already been mentioned, we are now at the end of the spring holy days, the Feast of Unleavened Bread. 7 days, we did the Passover, and then 7 days of Unleavened Bread, which we are now just completing today. And as mentioned, when the sun goes down, it ends today. We were told in four different places, three in Exodus, and we won't go to those places, but three in Exodus and one in Deuteronomy, we were told that 7 days we shall eat unleavened bread. 7 days we shall eat unleavened bread. We will, however, turn to Leviticus, the 23rd chapter, just sort of for the record. And in Leviticus, the 23rd, we're also told the same thing, pretty much. It says, on the 15th day of the same month, which is on the 14th day of the first month, and then at the 15th day of the same month is the Feast of Unleavened Bread to the Lord. 7 days you must, now this is the same word as it is in all those other four places, 7 days you must or you shall eat unleavened bread, which we have probably pretty much done. Most all of us, I would guess, that we have fulfilled that command and eaten unleavened bread for 7 days, and here we are now just coming down the home stretch. Pretty directly, it'll be over, and we'll look forward to the next feast day, which is Pentecost. I forget when that is. I should have looked it up, probably. It's probably at the end of May or end of June, I guess, 50 days, so whatever that is, from the Sabbath that fell during, actually from last Sabbath, it would have been 50 days, and then it'll be Pentecost. And, of course, then we celebrate that and go on to the fall holy days. But I wanted to mention that long ago we realized, as a church, we realized that what we're doing during these 7 days represents something. It sets forth God's plan. And what this represents, leaven, represents sin. Now, we would have been probably at a little bit of a loss for that, if not, again, for Paul and his message to the church in Corinth. And we'll go there. 1 Corinthians 5. It's a well-worn page in our Bibles, probably, because we go there quite a bit. Certainly, pretty much once or twice or more during these days, the days of unleavened bread, and at other times of the year too, just for the lesson that it portrays. In verse 7 it says, he wrote to the Corinthians, and we probably know most of the story here. There was some things going on in the Corinthian church that shouldn't have been going on, and the church was sort of almost proud of it, because that they were so tolerant and that they were so forgiving, or whatever you would want to say, to let this go on. But Paul wasn't happy about it. He says in verse 7, purge out the old leaven, that you may be a new lump, since you truly are unleavened. For indeed Christ, our Passover, was sacrificed for us. Therefore, because of all this, he said, let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, nor with the leaven of malice and wickedness. And here's where is a key point in us realizing that leaven stands for something, that it represents something. Only during this time. We don't have to feel guilty or anything outside of this period of time if we're eating things with leaven, although usually about the first couple of bites I do feel a little bit guilty when I get back to eating fluffy bread and cakes and pastry and donuts and all the good things that we miss. Although I do like matzos, the flat bread, the hard bread of affliction, I guess. I like it, but I'm always ready. It's like winter. I like winter for a short period of time, but I'm always ready when it gets towards the end of winter. I'm always ready for spring and warmer weather and sunshine. It's the same way here. I'm ready for some donuts and hamburgers. And Nonetheless, right here, malice and wickedness, we see that it stands for leaven. He compares it to leaven here. But don't keep the feast with those, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. Truth standing for what's right. Those things that are bedrock, those things that are the right things to do. Truth, what God gave us. Sincerity, purity, and what, like I said, what is right. Not to affect anything or to change anything, we have to identify clearly what it is. We can't sort of just use the shotgun approach and hope we hit the right thing or hit something. We have to identify what we're shooting at, what we're aiming for. And it's no different with sin. And what I'd like to do today, I'd like to bring a story to our attention that will clarify a little bit of what sin is. Now, when I say what sin is, I'm not talking about, you know, is playing cards sin? Or is dancing sin, which some of the folks that I deal with, which are pretty conservative churches I'm talking about, in the communities that I work in, you know, might think that that's the case. But that's not really what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the word sin itself, to clarify the definition of the word. And the story I want to talk there, or bring to our attention and talk about, is a story of the Benjamites, that what happened to the Benjamites. The Benjamites, as you probably know and realize, were the youngest son of Jacob, or Israel as he later became known as. They were fierce, warrior-like people for the most part. Very, very warlike, is the picture that's painted. And Jacob gave all his sons, he told them what's going to happen in their latter end, is the way I think it was put in Genesis, the 49th chapter. We don't necessarily need to go there, but if you might want to jot it down and read the 49th chapter of Genesis. It's next to the last book in Genesis. And read it and see what Jacob told his 12 sons, the 12 tribes of Israel, if you would. But he told Benjamin that he was going to be a wolf of a man, that he would tear things up during the day and divide the spoil at night, that he was going to be fierce, he was going to be warlike, that he was going to be a warrior, basically. And that's what he turned out to be. Turned out that they were a lot like that. Now, I don't know if that manifests itself so much today, if we see it. Maybe it does, and we just don't realize. It's very, very possible. Another thing about the Benjamites that is sort of fascinating and interesting, it seems like a high percentage of them were left-handed. Now, it doesn't mean that if you're left-handed, you're a Benjamite, but it could mean that. You might have Benjamite blood in you. It may be, but it doesn't necessarily mean that. I'm sure there were a lot of other people who were left-handed as well. But in their case, it's mentioned two or three times about the left-handers of Benjamin. And in some cases, they were even ambidextrous, were able to do things with both hands. Now, to get this story going, there was a Levite who lived in the mountains of Ephraim. And he took a wife, a concubine, from Bethlehem. Now, Bethlehem's down here, and then it's Jebus, or where the Jebusites lived, which later became Jerusalem. It wasn't Jerusalem at that time, because this is in the period of the Judges. And then north of that was Gibeah, which was part of Benjamin, and then Ephraim, north of that. So it was Bethlehem, Jerusalem, Gibeah, or Benjamin, and then the mountains of Ephraim in that order. Well, turns out that his wife was unfaithful, and she ran away from it. She ran back to, I don't know, since they didn't have the kind of communication that we do nowadays. I don't know how he found out, but she ran back home to her dad. And he decided, well, we're going to fix this. I'm going to go get her, which he did. Went back to her dad, and he chased her back there. And he found her. And I don't know if she was afraid to face him because of her, it said harlotry. And I don't know if that's the reason why she was afraid to face him and ran back to her dad or for other reasons. But nonetheless, whatever it was, he convinced her to come along back home with him. And after several false starts, and I know how this works, they were at her dad's house, and her dad, they wanted to leave, and her dad said, just stay overnight, it's getting later in the day, stay overnight, and you can head home tomorrow. Well, the next day it was the same thing, so they stayed overnight again. And the reason I say I know how this works is when my children come home to visit me, they say, well, we need to get going. Come on, just stay a little while longer. We're going to have something to eat or this or that or the other or stay overnight or whatever. We do the same thing. But finally, on I think the third day, he finally got headed back towards home to the mountains of Ephraim. And his father-in-law had detained him till late in the day. It was later in the day. So they took off, he and his concubine and his servant, and I think they had a donkey or something, some belongings. And when they got to Jerusalem, Jebus, I don't know if it's pronounced Jebus or Jebus. It could be either way, and I guess the Jebusites lived there. And when they got there, they decided they didn't want to stay there. So they went on to Gibeah, which was the next town sort of north of there, or somewhere north of there. Now it was getting dark, so they had to settle down for the night, and they decided they were just going to be in the town square because they couldn't find a place to lodge. Then this old man that was also from Ephraim, but he was living now in Gibeah, he came by, and he told them, or he said, why don't you just stay with me? You can stay with me in my house. I've got plenty of room, and we'll feed your animal, and you can bed down and have some food, and then in the morning you can continue. So that's what they did. But it was a lot like Sodom and Gomorrah. If you picture Sodom and Gomorrah, what happened to the angels when they came to visit Lot, the same thing happened there. The men of the town came in, they wanted the Levite, and the old man said, no, we can't do that. Somehow they decided to let him have the concubine. Well, it said they ravished her all night, and the next morning they threw her back on the porch and left. When the Levite came out, she was dead. They had killed her. Whatever had happened, they had killed her. So what the Levite did, he sent messages to every tribe, all the other 11 tribes of Israel, telling them what had happened. It infuriated, and we'll turn to chapter 20 of Judges. It's where the story, 19, 20, and 21 is where the story is if you ever want to read it. 21 is the last chapter in the book of Judges. But in chapter 20, and you're thinking, now what does this have to do with unleavened bread and sin? We'll get to that in a minute. And it infuriated the rest of the tribes of Israel, made them mad, and it should have, that this perversion happened and they killed a person. Basically, they raped her and killed her. And so in verse 12 of chapter 20, it says, then the tribes of Israel sent men through all the tribe of Benjamin after all this had happened, and they heard about it, saying, what is this wickedness that has occurred among you? Therefore, deliver up the men, the perverted men who are in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and remove the evil from Israel. But as I mentioned before, the children of Benjamin were fierce warriors. They thought they could handle everything. It says, but the children of Benjamin would not listen to the voice of their brethren, the children of Israel. Instead, the children of Benjamin gathered together from their cities to Gibeah to go to battle against the children of Israel. And from their cities at that time, the children of Benjamin numbered 26,000 men who drew the sword, besides the inhabitants of Gibeah, who numbered 700 select men. Now, the rest of them, now in verse 17, says, besides Benjamin, the men of Israel numbered 400,000 men, compared to the Gibeonites, or the Benjamites, who were 26,000. But the Benjamites were confident and so forth that we can handle this. We're not giving you these guys. We're not giving them up. And as I said, there were 400,000 men who drew the sword. All of these were men of war. They were fierce warriors, 400,000 people in all the combined tribes outside of the tribe of Benjamin. But they made a big mistake. They overestimated themselves. They made the decision that dearly cost them. To finish the rest of the story, after several tries, the rest of the tribes of Israel killed all but 600 men of the tribe of Benjamin. That was all that was left, men, women, and children. That's all that was left. And it caused a problem, but you can read that at some point in chapter 21. What we wanted to see, though, was verse 16. Now, I said all this, and I could have just read verse 16 and gone from there, but everything happens in a context. God does things in a context. He gave the Ten Commandments in a context. He brought the children of Israel out in a context. Everything happens so that it's easier for us to understand. He says, among all this people, this is the Benjamites. And it seems like they were maybe all from, these people were all from Gibeah. Among all this people were 700 select men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss. They could sling a hair, they could hit split hairs, so to speak, with a stone and not miss. Now, David was not a Benjamite, but you remember when he took his sling and he hit a Goliath right in the forehead between his eyes with the smooth stones that he had picked up in the brook. That's what these people were. All 700 of them could do that. I want to read you what that word is. The word here for miss is, it's called in Hebrew, it's Strong's number 2398. Now, I'll read this from Vine's Expository Dictionary of Biblical Words. Strong's gives you a short definition, but Vine's breaks it down a little bit more, puts it in more context, and you end up understanding it just a little better. The word is H-A-T-A, which looks like it's pronounced hate, and it says that the word, the primary meaning of the word is miss, which it says here, miss. But the next word is sin. It's one of the primary words that's used for sin in the Old Testament. Maybe the primary word that's used for pure sin in the Old Testament. The basic meaning, it says, of this verb, hate, is illustrated in Judges 20:16. What these 700 men could do. And the meaning is extended in Proverbs 19:2. He who makes haste with his feet misses the way. So it's about missing. But it's the word for the primary, one of the primary words in the Old Testament for sin is this particular word. And that's why this is used as an illustration to clarify it, to make it a little more easy to understand. From this word, or basic meaning, comes the word, the word's chief usage to indicate moral failure, or better known as sin. Now, it says the Septuagint, and the Septuagint is the Greek translation of the Bible. Translates the group of words, which there are a couple of these particular words, but it translates the group of words with this verb and the nouns in it, translates it 540 times. They occur 265 times in the New Testament. Now let's see what they say about the same word in the New Testament, because we know, because of the same numbers, that it is the same word from the Septuagint. If we didn't have the Greek translation, then we might be a little bit of a loss. But now we can specifically point to this same verse, because the Greek translation of this word is translated into words that we can read in the New Testament. So let's see what the New Testament says. Same word. There are three words, 264, 265, and 266 in Strong's, that basically all mean the same thing. And what it means, it's a missing of the mark. A missing of the mark is what this is. And it's translated that way in the New Testament, even more prominently than it is in the Old Testament. But it says this etymological meaning is largely lost sight of in the New Testament. It is the most comprehensive term for moral obligity, which is sort of a fancy word for saying failure or sound thinking or whatever. But this is the primary word for sin in the New Testament, is missing the mark. Missing the mark. And that's the title of the message today, missing the mark. So let's go back to one of those words. And it's in Romans 3:23. It actually, by reading it in this light, actually clarifies it a little bit. It says, Romans 3:23 says, and we're all familiar with this verse, "For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God." Now, if you look at that word sin, all have missed the mark and fall short of the glory of God, it makes a little more sense, because it's like you're throwing your stone with your sling. I can't do it with my left hand, I guess, but if you were throwing those stones with a sling, it sounds like they came up short. They didn't quite make it to the mark or the target, is what it sort of indicates here, which in this case was the glory of God. Or if you're shooting a bow, and I do some deer hunting with, excuse me, mostly with crossbows, which I'm tell myself I don't have time to practice enough to get good with a regular bow, but nonetheless, the crossbow also has its limitations, because 40 feet is, well, 50 feet maybe, or yards, is about its maximum effectiveness. And if you're going to shoot at an object further than that, you're liable, just like here, to miss the mark and fall short. So think of sin a little bit in that, or in those terms, of missing the mark. Not quite reaching the goal that you had hoped to. Not quite coming up with everything that you were shooting for, or not quite hitting the target, so to speak. Now, I guess the question is, how can we be more like those 700 left-handed Benjamites and not miss? Are there things that we could do? Are there things that we can do as we go forward to remain, in our context today, unleavened? Because let's not kid ourselves, it's not just through these 7 days that the lesson is for, that the analogy stands for. It's going forward, it's to improve our life. It's to improve our aim. It's to improve us hitting the mark or hitting the target. But that's a big question. How can we get better at it? That's the task that we are challenged with as we go forward. There were a couple of great left-handed pitchers, and some of you will maybe not all of you, but some of you will remember these names when I say them. Two of them were Sandy Koufax, who may have been the greatest pitcher of all, some people feel that way, and another one was Randy Johnson. And perhaps these folks were Benjamites. Maybe they were. Sandy Koufax, now it doesn't sound like it, but Sandy Koufax was actually Jewish. And if you know some of the history of what happened, Jews, Benjamites, and Levites were sort of all lumped together. And it's possible that he could have been a Benjamite. It's not beyond the realm of possibility. One of the famous things he did, he refused to pitch the first game of the 1965 World Series because it fell on, what do you think, the Day of Atonement. And he wouldn't pitch. And then, of course, with a name like Johnson, John's son, I couldn't verify that he was Jewish or wasn't, but that would also fit into that category of names, at least, that would possibly lend themselves to having an Israelite background or possibly a Benjamite background. Not saying that either one of them were, but they could have been. Sandy Koufax, by the way, his original name was Sanford Braun, B-R-A-U-N. His dad left at an early age. He was so disillusioned by it and so irritated by it that when her mom married another fellow whose last name was Koufax, he took that name. So it sort of obscures a little bit who he was. But both of these guys were wild as could be when they couldn't hit the plate. They'd be more likely to hit the batter than the plate, basically, when they started pitching. And they went along, and they did not start winning many baseball games till later on in their career because of it. Because they were not able to hit the target or hit the mark. Then one day, in Sandy Koufax's case, and a similar incident happened to Randy Johnson also. One day, somebody came along and asked him what his style or what he used to pitch when he was throwing the ball. Where was he throwing it? Well, I'm throwing it on the outside portion, half of the plate. The guy said, no, you can't do that. If you want to get good, you throw it at the outside edge of the plate, right on the edge of the plate, and that's what you look at, that's what you aim for. Because if you're going to just throw it at the half of a plate, you're going to be all over the place. But if you start concentrating on one spot, you will get better. A similar thing happened to Randy Johnson as well. Now, in Randy Johnson's case, some of his wildness was maybe a little bit put on because batters were just totally afraid to stand in against him because they didn't know whether the ball was going to hit them or be a strike. They couldn't tell. I remember watching an all-star game. And there was a guy, a left-handed hitter, who was really good. His name was John Kruk. And he came to the plate, and he had the bat, and one pitch came in, and it whistled right by him, and he just shook his head, started cracking a smile, and he just sort of leaned the bat on his shoulder, stepped back, and let him strike him out. Because he didn't hardly even take the bat off his shoulder because he knew that he didn't have much of a chance of hitting him, and he was afraid to stand in the batter's box. So that may have been part of Randy Johnson's strategy. But nonetheless, he got much, much better as he went along at hitting the strike zone because he knew what he was doing. He was focusing on a spot. He was focusing on hitting one particular area rather than a broad area, hoping to get it in the bushel basket. He was hoping to get it into the center of the bushel basket, into the target. That's the first thing we have to do if we're going to start hitting the mark more often. If we're going to learn to have control, we're going to have to focus on the target. Notice in 1 John 3:4. Because the question then comes up, what is the target? What target should we be looking at? 1 John 3, and again, most all of these scriptures that we're going to today are very, very familiar. They're not scriptures that we haven't seen or heard and read many, many times. 1 John 3:4 says, "Whoever commits sin also commits lawlessness, and sin is lawlessness." And in verse 5 says, "You know that he was manifested to take away our sins, and in him there is no sin. Whoever abides in him or stays in him does not sin. Whoever sins has neither seen him nor known him." Now, here's part of the answer to the question of what is the mark or what is the target. "Little children, let no one deceive you. He who practices righteousness is righteous, just as he," Jesus Christ, "is righteous." Now, righteousness, again, is rightness, doing the right thing. It's rightness to be able to do what is right. Where it says here, practices, those same words in verse 4, that where it says commits both times, are the same exact word as this word here, practices. And if we read it that way, it says, "Whoever practices missing the mark also practices lawlessness, and sin is missing or lawlessness." So whoever practices, you get what you practice. In sports, they will tell you that you play like you practice. So if you practice missing the mark, that's how you're going to play. If you practice hitting the mark, that's also what you're going to do. You'll get better at hitting the mark. But again, it has to be identified. Matthew, the 5th chapter, the famous Sermon on the Mount that Jesus Christ gave, apparently early in his ministry. Matthew 5. And the Sermon on the Mount goes from Matthew 5 through Matthew 7. But we'll just read a couple of verses here. Matthew 5:17 is where we will start. And again, we will see a little bit more of what the mark or the target is. It says, Jesus Christ said, "Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets." So that's not going away. "I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For assuredly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, one jot," which is, I believe, one iota, "or the smallest stroke of a pen, or one tittle, will by no means pass from the law till everything or all is fulfilled." Then verse 19, "Whoever therefore breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches men so, shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven." So we see here, straight from the mouth of Jesus Christ, the law is to be kept, and it's not going away. Verse 20, "For I say to you that unless your rightness or your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven." So righteousness, doing the right thing, rightness, is part of that mark, part of the target. We won't go there, but in Philippians 2:5 it says, "Let this mind also be in you, which is in Jesus Christ." Those are some of the things we want to develop. Some of the things that we are hoping or we should be working on. Now, once we've identified the mark or the target, how can we go about assuring that our percentages of hitting it are greater? How can we hit the mark or the target more often? How can we be more confident that we can hit that? Well, how did the 700 lefties, who were the lefty slingers of stones, the Benjamites, how did they do there? Do you think they woke up one morning as little boys and all of a sudden picked up a sling and bam, they were good at it? Some people have an aptitude for some things. I'm not saying that they may not have had a lot of aptitude for it, but guess what they had to do. Just like Sandy Koufax and Randy Johnson, they had to do the very same things. They had to practice, practice, practice. In real estate, they say there are three things to know about real estate. Location, location, location. Well, there's three things to know about hitting the mark. Practice, practice, practice. It's our obligation and our job to practice our craft, to practice at getting better, to practice staying unleavened. If leaven is sin, then we want to be unleavened. And if sin is missing the mark, then we want to hit the mark. That's what we want to practice at. But how do you practice righteousness? Well, it starts out in 1 Timothy 3 in verse 16, one of those other very, very familiar scriptures that we often go to. Yeah, did I say first? I meant 2 Timothy 3:16. And here it says, all scripture, and you have it in your hands, I have it in my hands. We have it so easy. We don't have to dig out big scrolls at some library or some synagogue or wherever. We can go to our bookshelf or wherever we keep our Bibles, pull it down, and we can start studying. We can start reading it. All scripture, it says in verse 16, is given by inspiration of God, and it's profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, and notice this last one, instruction in righteousness. That's where we start. We start to look and see what is righteousness, what is right, what is true. Thy word is truth is what we read in another section of the Bible. That the man of God, verse 17, that the man of God may be complete, thoroughly equipped for every good work. So we're equipped, thoroughly equipped to hit the mark, to hit the target. We know what the target is. Now we have to practice, practice, practice till we can hit the target every time. Takes a lot of work, takes a lot of effort. It's not going to happen immediately. Anything that we are working with, if you're struggling with something, the further away, let's say you were addicted to cigarettes, just as an example, and you say today, well, I am going to quit cigarettes. That first day, that first next day, that first week, that first month, that probably first year will be very difficult and a struggle. You probably, now some people, like I say, have more aptitude for certain things than others, and some people can sort of give it up quickly. But most people struggle with it, and it takes a long time for them to overcome it, to where they don't, when they wake up in the morning, think, oh, I have to have that cigarette, or right after lunch, we have to go out and have a cigarette. You know, all those things that trigger that particular addiction. All those things, when they, excuse me, when they come around, we will have a struggle with it at first. But as time goes on, we will get better and better and better and better at it. And the further away we get from it, the better we will get at it. In we won't turn back there. It's right here, but we won't turn to it. But in 2 Timothy 2:15, it says, study to show yourself approved, rightly dividing the word of God. It says it a little different here in the New King James, which I'm reading. But it means basically the same thing as we would read in the regular King James, to study to show yourself approved. It says be diligent here. In Luke, the 16th chapter, we get another little tidbit on how to get better at righteousness. And it's a little bit like quitting cigarettes. You have to start somewhere. In this case, Luke, the 16th chapter, we'll read verse 10 and 11. It says, he who is faithful in a little is also faithful in, or he who is faithful in what is least, it says here, is faithful also in much, and he who is unjust in what is least is also unjust in what is much. So we have to start small. We have to, if we're having a struggle with righteousness or what doing what's right, we need to start with small things. We need to start building on those small things till we can be stronger, spiritually speaking, till we can accomplish things that maybe at first we wouldn't have been able to. Therefore, it says in verse 11, if you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the truth or the true riches? We have to start working at it, and we have to start building from small victories, starting out small and growing. We have many, many, many opportunities to grow in small ways, in just little things. Maybe we're having a struggle at work saying no to, maybe we have a lot of people around us, and oftentimes we do if we're working, that might use bad language. Maybe we struggle with that, not developing that habit as well. But it's a little thing. It's a small thing. It's not a huge thing. If we start making a determined effort to not use bad language and to eliminate bad language out of our life little by little by little by little, we can make big progress in it over time. But it doesn't happen all of a sudden. We have to make the effort. Going back to Matthew, the fifth chapter, to the Sermon on the Mount, there are some things here, in fact, where we left off from there on to the end of, basically the end of chapter 7, which the Sermon on the Mount was in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. But there are a number of key things here, small things, that we can take a hold of and that we can look at, and we know their righteousness because basically Jesus Christ framed them that way. In verse 20, which we read, it says, for I say that unless your righteousness or your rightness or your how you act exceeds the righteousness of the scribes and Pharisees, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. And going on to 21, you have heard that it was said to them of to those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be in danger of the judgment. Well, who among us is going to murder? Not very likely to happen. There was a, last week we were down at our daughter's house in Carrollton, and just the day before or 2 days before, they had found a couple miles from her house, just outside of Carrollton, they had found a young man, a 14-year-old boy, buried in a shallow grave. He'd been missing for a week. And they found him there. Murder takes place all the time. And like I say, we are amongst our people. Probably not. But Jesus Christ didn't stop there. He said, verse 22, but I say to you that whoever is angry with his brother. And we're going to stop right there for a second. If we have a problem with anger, Jesus Christ, or one of the, I think it was Paul who said, don't let the sun go down on your wrath, or one of the I believe it was in the Gospels, don't let the sun go down on your wrath, on your anger. And Jesus Christ said, I say that whoever is angry with his brother shall be in danger of judgment. So if we have problems with being angry, with anger and anger management and flying off the handle and doing things that causes a lot of trouble, oftentimes many mistakes are made in haste and in anger. When we're angry, we tend to say things that we shouldn't. We tend to do things that we shouldn't. We need to step back. It's a small thing, but we need to step back take a deep breath and cool down and not do anything till the moment has passed and we've recovered. But we can start doing that, dealing little by little by little with anger. And it's that way with many things, not just anger. It's that way with many things. We can little by little, we can overcome them. And they are all by themselves. A lot of these things are small things. They're not big things. He who is faithful in little will also be faithful in much, as we read in Luke 16. Finishing the verse, it says, whoever is angry without cause shall be in danger of judgment. And then he goes on to explain a little further, whoever says, I think it means fool, to his brother, you fool, shall be in danger of the council. No, later on it says that. But whoever says you fool shall be in danger of hell fire. So there are steps. If we don't stop them at certain points before they get out of hand, certain things can lead to such big things that we can't overcome them, that are where we're out of control and so forth. Anger is one of them. As I said, this whole chapter and the whole next two chapters in the Sermon on the Mount give us little things that we can do to build righteousness, to hit the mark, to hit the target, to become more righteous. And again, righteousness is rightness, or doing the right thing. And that's exactly what we want to do. We do not want to let things get out of hand to where all of a sudden it's hard to come back from all these things. But anyway, we can look through Matthew 5, 6, and 7, and we can find pointers, little things. It says, you've heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. Well, he goes on to say here, whoever looks at a woman to lust, and this applies to many different things, not just adultery, has already committed adultery in her heart. So don't look. Look the other way when things that you should not be seeing are happening. It's a small thing, but we can learn to do those small things. We can learn to become better at them, but it takes time and it takes effort. It takes focus. We have to focus on hitting the mark, hitting the target. We can't just, as I mentioned before, take the shotgun approach and hope we hit what we would like to hit, because we may or we may not. Oftentimes we don't. To review a little bit, we are called to live an unleavened life, not just these 7 days. These things happen every year to remind us every year to be vigilant and to be careful and to be on our guard and to work at it every year all the time. Satan is on the job 24/7. He's looking for little, says he throws those fiery darts at us. He's looking for those, just those tiny little seams in our armor where those darts can penetrate and have an effect. And oftentimes, if we're not careful, that happens. Because he, as I said, is on the job all the time. And it seems, and I think the Bible in God's Word indicates this, that year by year, as it gets closer and as it ramps up and ratchets up, that he becomes more ferocious. He becomes more on the prowl, so to speak. That he becomes more determined than ever. He doesn't give up. And he understands our weaknesses. He sees what we're doing. A lot of things he does, he sort of sets in motion, and he's got so many things in motion and going that a lot of things sort of almost take care of themselves. But sin is missing the mark. Our task and our challenge is to hit the mark, is to overcome that missing of the mark or the target. How do we do that? again, like those 700 slingers did, or Sandy Koufax and Randy Johnson, we practice at it. We work at it. We try to identify what the mark or the target is, which in our case would be to be more righteous. And we're tuning out the background noise of people who say, well, you can't righteous yourself into the kingdom or whatever. Yes, we are saved by grace, but we are still called on to live righteous lives, even though grace does cover our sins. But Paul said, should we sin so that grace should abound? Absolutely not, he said. And that's what we want to do. We want to overcome those. We need to practice hitting the target to remain unleavened going forward. These days are short, and they seem like they just went in the blink of an eye. And now it's already the last day. It just goes so quickly. And yeah, while I'm ready for the hamburgers and the donuts and all that good, those good things, I did enjoy the matzos, especially the salt and onions ones with butter. I did like those. But going forward, we still need to keep this lesson in the back of our mind. We still need to work at it as we continue to go forward. So, concluding, you know what? And I was thinking about this. Missing the mark would be, or falling short, would be leavened bread, would it not? It would be sort of an analogy to leavened bread. Hitting the mark would be the unleavened bread, would it not? So with that in mind, I'm going to change the title of this sermon to Hitting the Mark. Keep up the good work.